in shelter in those areas after the Israeli occupation forces expelled them out of their residential areas. It's worth mentioning that every time the Israeli military demands the Palestinian people to evacuate from the camps of the central area of Gaza Strip, they demand them to go to Deir al-Balah. This time, the Israeli military demanded the Palestinian people from Al-Burij and the Nusrat refugee camp to go to Al-Mawasi area in the western part of Khan Yunis city. This actually raises more concerns among the people in Deir al-Balah city that Deir al-Balah could be subjected to another ground offensive. Israeli warplanes also resumed their airstrikes and attacks against Al-Burij refugee camp. At least 5 residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli fighter jets over the last night in Al-Burij refugee camp. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery continued to shell the eastern part of Deir al-Balah and Al-Burij, in addition to the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Israeli occupation forces are still carrying out their brutal ground offensive against the eastern part of Khan Yunis city. When it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli attacks were ongoing and incessant against those areas, basically a Sabra neighborhood, whereas the Israeli fighter jets destroyed multiple residential buildings there, in addition to a residential apartment. Scores of the Palestinian casualties were left behind those ongoing attacks.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has declared next Saturday as a national and international day in support of Gaza and Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh called for a massive turnout of pro-Gaza demonstrations on August the 3rd. He said demonstrators on that day should demand an end to the Gaza genocide and Israel's abuse of heroic Palestinian prisoners. Elsewhere in his call, Haniyeh referred to Israel as the Nazi Zionist occupation, saying the number of Palestinian detainees killed in the regime's custody has seen an unprecedented increase. The Hamas chief also slammed international silence on Gaza and the inability to stop the aggression against the Palestinian nation and its prisoners at Israel's detention centers. He also denounced the U.S. for its unbridled support for Israel. The latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks has been held in the Italian capital. Representatives from the U.S., Qatar, Egypt, and Israel took part in the negotiations, while no Palestinian representative was in attendance. Our correspondent Max Civilli has more from Rome.
On Sunday, a summit aimed at discussing a ceasefire agreement in Gaza and the release of Israeli captives held by Hamas kicked off in Rome. The meeting was attended by CIA Director William Burns, Prime Minister of Qatar Mohammed bin Abdel Rahman Al Thani, head of the Egyptian intelligence Abbas Kamal, and the head of Israel's Mossad spy agency David Barnea. No Palestinian representative was invited to join the summit. The Israeli representative to the talks, David Barnea, however, returned to Israel according to an announcement by the regime. He left the negotiations in Rome presumably to monitor the situation following a rocket attack on a football pitch in the town of the Majda Shams in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, where at least 12 people were killed and 30 others wounded. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah categorically denied any responsibility for the strike. Palestinians residing in Italy expressed pessimism that any positive outcome can be achieved through the Rome summit.
I think that this meeting is part of a strategy that allows Netanyahu to buy even more time to continue with his massacres in Gaza and Lebanon. If the US and the Europeans really wanted to reach peace in Gaza, they would have stopped sending weapons to Israel long ago. Israel has never complied with international norms and has broken hundreds of UN resolutions.
International media have reported that ahead of the Rome summit, Israel submitted an updated proposal to Washington for a deal with Hamas, which includes new demands for negotiation, including establishing a monitoring mechanism for the movement of Palestinian weapons and resistance fighters, and maintaining Israeli control over the Philadelphia corridor between Gaza and Egypt. This condition could hamper the Gaza ceasefire negotiations. Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah have recently signed a joint statement in Beijing aimed at ending divisions between the two rivals. In a meeting brokered by China, representatives from the groups, along with 12 other Palestinian factions, have pledged to work on forming an interim national reconciliation government for the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip.
The Rome summit must be seen against the backdrop of the deal inked between Hamas and Fatah, as well as the roles of different mediators in Gaza ceasefire talks. Tel Aviv's decision to hold the meeting in Rome can be seen as a way to reward Giorgia Meloni's government for its staunch support for Israel and the U.S.
The Rome summit will continue for at least 2 more days, even though no major breakthrough in Gaza ceasefire talks is expected. Meanwhile, fears are growing over the eruption of an all-out war in West Asia amid Israel's repeated threats to other countries. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli forces have abducted at least 7 Palestinians in their latest raid in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinians were taken away when Israeli troopers stormed an area south of Bethlehem overnight. A young Palestinian man was also abducted during an Israeli raid on his home in Tulkarm. The regime frequently storms Palestinian neighborhoods in the West Bank and abducts Palestinians affiliated with Palestinian resistance groups. Those operations have intensified since Israel began its Gaza onslaught in early October. The regime has abducted more than 9,800 Palestinians across the West Bank since then. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has won re-election to another 6-year term in office.
With 80% of the polling stations counted and a 59% turnout, the results are as follows. First, Nicolas Maduro Moros obtained 5,150,992 votes with 51.2%. We congratulate the new president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, candidate Nicolas Maduro Moros.
Maduro has hailed his win as a victory against what he called imperialism. He has been already in power for 12 years, and the win gives him a third term. But his main opponent, Edmundo Gonzalez, who was quick to claim victory after the election, has refused to recognize the results. Gonzalez is alleging irregularities and has called for a new vote. Iran has congratulated Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro on his victory in the country's presidential election. Iran's acting foreign minister welcomed the large turnout in the election, despite threats and unfair sanctions that it has been facing. Ali Bagheri-Khani reiterated Iran's support for Venezuela's national development plans and called for stronger bilateral cooperation. The Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel have offered their congratulations to Maduro on his election win, describing it as a historic triumph. Iran's acting foreign minister has met with Cuba's deputy foreign minister, who was in Tehran for the inauguration ceremony of President Masoud Pezeshkian. During the meeting, Ali Bagheri-Khani hailed Cuba's approach to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. He called for the continuation of talks between the two countries in this regard. Bagheri-Khani stressed the necessity of strengthening bilateral cooperation and improving capacities to face unilateralism. For his part, Elio Rodriguez Perdomo expressed support for Palestinian rights. He said confronting the Israeli genocide in Gaza is a top priority in Havana's foreign policy. Perdomo also reiterated his country's readiness to cooperate with the new government in Iran to improve bilateral and multilateral ties. The senior diplomat said Cuba's prime minister will also attend the presidential inauguration ceremony in Tehran. Pro-Palestinian protesters have torn down an Israeli flag flying outside of a venue of the Paris Olympic Games alongside the flags of other participating countries. Footage of the incident released on X social networking website shows a protester climbing a flag post and ripping down the regime's flag as a security officer tries to pull him down. Israeli media are also reporting that Algerian judoka Massoud Roudanoue Driss disqualified himself from participating in the games to avoid a face-off with an Israeli opponent. He was to compete against an Israeli rival in his opening game. The Algerian team has rejected the report, although such moves are familiar acts of protest to question the legitimacy of Israel. Meanwhile, a video clip has been circulating on social media platforms showing Israeli athletes as soldiers in the regime's military prior to the Olympic Games. Students in Bangladesh have called for the resumption of protests after a week-long halt over the government's refusal to release their leaders. The leaders were detained alongside thousands of others during rallies over reintroduction of public job quotas earlier this month. The students had earlier given the government an ultimatum to release the leaders and apologize for the deaths of over 200 people in the demos. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's government, however, has responded with a curfew and shutting down of the internet. Her administration triggered the protests by a scheme that reserves half of all public jobs for specific groups of its loyalists. This is amid an unemployment figure of 18 million people. South Korea, the U.S., and Japan on Sunday signed a military cooperation agreement in Tokyo. While increased security coordination between the three countries may be viewed as beneficial in Japan and the U.S., many South Koreans oppose any military cooperation with Tokyo, having suffered under Japan's colonial dominion for decades early in the 20th century. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Encouraged by the United States, South Korea and Japan have strengthened the three countries' trilateral alliance, with their defense chiefs signing a military cooperation agreement in Tokyo on Sunday. The move comes amid South Korea's efforts to join the global U.S.-led alliance system. The U.S.-Japan-South Korea alliance has been shaken by the strengthening of ties between China and Russia and the mutual defense treaty recently concluded between North Korea and Russia. South Korea's defense minister, Shin Won-sik, became the first to visit Japan in 15 years, symbolic of South Korea's move to solidify an alliance, including the U.S. But such cooperation is widely viewed negatively in South Korea, which suffered under Japan's colonial rule from 1910 to 1945. Polls show South Koreans hesitant to trust Japan because it's seen as failing to adequately atone for its past, and many worry a robust alliance will only raise tensions with North Korea and South Korea's largest trading partner, China. Still, the military leaders say their memorandum will increase exchanges and joint military exercises for their troops, including the 80,000 U.S. forces stationed there. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a vibrant display of talent and collaboration, students from across the globe have gathered in Iran for the 54th International Physics Olympiad. Competition challenges young minds through rigorous theoretical and experimental physics tests. Gisumi Shahmedi has more.
A spectacular celebration of talent and achievement. In Iran's central city of Isfahan, the 54th International Physics Olympiad came to a thrilling conclusion as top achievers proudly accepted their awards. The Chinese team stood out, taking home 5 gold medals and securing the top spot in this prestigious competition. Following China, the Russian team secured 4 gold medals and 1 silver, while Romania earned 3 golds and 2 silvers. Iran also performed impressively, winning 1 gold and 4 silver medals, placing them 4th overall in both individual and team standings.
This is only motivation for me to continue studying physics and do research one day.
The examination was difficult for me. When I wrote examination, I think I could barely win bronze.
According to IPHO officials, this year the competition among the top teams was exceptionally close. The 54th International Physics Olympiad began on July 22nd at Isfahan University of Technology, a prestigious university that also hosted the 38th Olympiad 17 years ago.
Hosting Olympiads and scientific events of this caliber not only raises a country's educational standards, but also requires the host to meet certain benchmarks. In Iran, we excel in basic sciences, which is why we're proud to host the Physics Olympiad for the second time.
The International Physics Olympiad has come a long way since its inception in Poland over 50 years ago, when it began with only 5 teams. This year, 198 elite students from 46 countries demonstrated their physics talents through theoretical and experimental challenges that tested both their knowledge and problem-solving skills.
Here at the closing ceremony of the 54th International Physics Olympiad, we celebrate not just the winners, but the spirit of collaboration and innovation among young physicists from around the world. Their passion for science inspires us all. Isum Shahmadi, Isfahan.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the part of the message delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the scholars overseeing the 5th Global Conference of Imam Rida, peace be upon him, on May 8, 2024. What they narrate to us about the behavior of you, dear Iraqi brothers, at the Mawakib, places set up for Kater Husseini pilgrim on the way to Karbala, and your generous behavior towards Husseini pilgrims are things which are unprecedented. Such things are unprecedented in today's world. The Arba'een rally is unprecedented in history. Such is your generous behavior in the true sense of the word. You have shown Islamic and Arba'een generosity through your conduct and your actions, and all originate from the love of the Master of Martyrs, peace be upon him, from the love of Hussein ibn Ali. You do these things because you greatly love Imam Hussein alayhi salam. You wash the feet of Husseini pilgrims. You help their bodies when exposed to extreme fatigue. You massage them. You feed them and give them places to sleep because they are the pilgrims of Hussein. This love for Hussein ibn Ali is an extraordinary matter. We do not know of similar events anywhere in the world and at any time in the world. I hope that Allah the Exalted will make you and I have more of this love in our hearts.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the opportunity that you have in this regard is a blessing that God has bestowed on you. The blessing that you have at your disposal to cater the guests of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is a very valuable phenomenon. This is a divine blessing. This is a divine mercy which should be appreciated, and I know that you already appreciate it. The second point is about the essence of this Arba'een rally, which is truly an unprecedented event, not only in our own times, but also in history. We do not know of any similar gathering in history which is organized more warmly every year. It is unprecedented. This Hussein movement is influential in raising awareness about Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. With the rally that primarily takes place between Najaf and Karbala every year, Arba'een has become global. The people all over the world are glued to this movement. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and Husseini knowledge have become global thanks to this great popular movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done for me.
Dear listeners, this is the second part of A Window to Palestine. A Window to Palestine.
Muy bien, ya estamos de regreso y en este tercer bloque...
Well, we are back, and in this section, we're going to continue learning more about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. In this part, we're going to talk with the lawyer Mar Pichara, who was a leader of the General Union of Palestinian Students of Chile, which has had a presence in our country since 1981, despite the fact that at the beginning he did not even know about the World General Union of Palestinian Students. Mar is a lawyer and has been a permanent activist for the Palestinian cause. Let's learn more about him.
La ONU nunca creyó en los dos estados.
The UN never believed in states. This massacre that no one stops is proof of this, says Maher Pichara Buye, lawyer and first-generation Palestinian in Chile. He has traveled on several occasions to the land where most of his family still lives. Every time he comes back, the situation gets worse, he says. The wall continues to be built, illegal settlements proliferate, Zionist checkpoints are stricter and more humiliating. It is becoming increasingly difficult to live there. For this reason, Pichara Buye believes the broader organization is necessary, not only of the Palestinian diaspora, but also of all international organizations whose goal is to stop Israel. Maher believes fervently in the cause of his people. His conviction comes from his grandparents who farmed the land in Beit Jalal. If an Israeli faces a problem, they simply return to their home, to New York, to Europe, or to Russia. Unlike us, that is, if this genocide continues, we will have nowhere to return.
Hola, Maher, ¿cómo estás?
Hello, Mar. How are you? Thank you very much for accepting this invitation. I want to start by asking you about your family's history. What generation are you? When do your parents, your father, and your mother arrive in our country?
Tu madre a nuestro país.
Bueno, muchas gracias a ti, Daniel, por la invitación, y también gracias a los que están hoy presentes.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for the invitation. Also, thanks to those who are today present in the program. The truth is that my father arrived in 1967 in the June War, or better known, as some call it, the Six-Day War, which really did not last 6 days. And my mother arrived in 1988 in the First Intifada.
During the First Intifada?
Later, at the end of the First Intifada, which everyone will remember for the Stones Against the Tanks, which was the first televised uprising and which also generated sentiment among the world's population.
I have a doubt. Sorry for asking you. So she arrived in 1988, because the First Intifada broke out on December 9th, 1987, days after the assassination of Abu Iyad in Egypt, who was the one who was working to internalize the resistance and change the axis of resistance from struggle of outside towards a struggle with your own feet sunk into the ground, taking various examples from history, such as the history of Vietnam. I mean, of all the guests we have had, I think you are from the first generation born in Chile.
Primera generación nacida en Chile.
Primera generación.
First generation. And well, I'm very grateful to my parents who taught us the language from a young age. From a young age, they spoke Arabic at home. And that is also a component. It is an important cultural component to maintain it over time.
Did you learn Arabic before Spanish?
I learned Arabic before Spanish, and they had to send us teachers from educational centers asking them to please teach them Spanish.
Very nice.
So of course, and it was in that instance where one would understand that he or she had a homeland, that she or he had a culture, a language, a cause. But then you see that you can't find the name of Palestine on the world map, and that is where one begins to study, begins to investigate, and then this issue begins to be internalized and a permanent process that lasts until today.
El amor y el apego a Palestina.
Is the love and attachment to Palestine passed on to you from your parents, your father and your mother? Because from what we have seen with other interviewees who have been invited, is that the first generation that arrives, those who arrived, first enter a period of denial and hardly pass on anything of what we have called Palestinianness to their children. How is it with you? Because this is different. The Palestinians who arrive among the immigrations at the beginning of the century are different from those who arrive after specific milestones that are already directly related to the occupation and the establishment of the Zionist regime in Palestine.
That's right. I can tell from the talks I had with the generations of that time that, yes, they've told me that they have avoided Arab names, that they have not passed on the culture for fear of being discriminated against. But in my case, my father, as he arrived in 1967, and my mother, as she arrived in 1988, I have an Arabic name, and it is also an element that marks the difference between these generations, and that they were my own parents. Because when you grow up in a family nucleus like this, generally, there is no good news, and one begins to wonder why there is no good news, why what always arrives is administrative detention, summary executions, new colonies, and these bad news come from my own relatives who are in Palestine, my grandfather, my uncles, my cousins. They sent me the news to my parents. This sentiment is always alive in the family environment with the TV on. If they see someone listening to the news about Palestine or hear something about the settlement, they immediately pay attention, and this has formed and created such an environment. My own parents and my own relatives in Palestine have taken care to maintain this sentiment, and I hope to also maintain it for future generations.
De nosotros.
Tu familia.
Your family is surely the same as mine. I was born on June 28, 1967, when the Israelis annexed Jerusalem al-Quds after the war of 1967. And both our families come from the Christian area of Palestine, more particularly from the Bethlehem neighborhood, and specifically from the town of Beit Jalal. It is a city that today has about 17,000 inhabitants, and if all the Palestinians from Beit Jalal who live in Chile, if they returned, they would not fit simply because there are more Palestinians from Beit Jalal here than there. And the million-dollar question, we all know that this did not start on October the 7th, but I would like to know how your family has experienced this episode of the policy of physical and political extermination of the Palestinian people carried out by Israel. The economy has been paralyzed. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the West Bank have been detained and kidnapped, and anyone who smells of resistance is today in jail, waiting, in quotes, for the exchange negotiations. How has your family experienced it particularly, and what has the relationship been like? How smooth has the relationship been with those who are there?
Con los que están allá.
A ver, Daniel, para abordar esta pregunta, siempre a mí me gusta.
Let's see, Daniel. To address this question, I always like to explain a quote, and then we'll get to it. In 1923, Vladimir Jabotinsky wrote an essay called The Iron Wall, and there he pointed out that the Zionist movement is a colonial movement, and that they should behave just like Cortes and Pizarro, as they behaved in Latin America, like the bandits of Cortes and Pizarro, and that the natives will never leave their land of their own with free will, so they have to go in this colonial racist segregating and, as we see today, genocidal movement. And this has permeated the politics of the regime of Israel since before 1948. Because the Palestinians also suffered extermination and exile under the British mandate, which continues to this day. As a result, today in Palestine, breathing is resistance. Existing, breathing, living, waking up, and everything in Palestine equals to resistance. And when my grandfather's land was expropriated to build a road or highway for exclusive Israel use in Beit Jalal, in Mahrour, which is an area declared a World Heritage Site by UNESCO, it is simply expropriated to make a road for exclusive Israel use for settlers within the occupied Palestinian territory. What is this, Daniel? This is apartheid. This is segregation. This is racism. And this is what also happens in another area, which was full of old trees. It was the lungs, the green lungs of earth in that area in Palestine. So when I travel to Palestine and I see that I can't go anywhere, for example, with my family, this is humiliating. They don't give my grandfather permission, and he's already old. I see my grandmother's tears when she cannot visit various regions of her own country where she was born and raised with my father and great-grandfather. This is honestly quite painful, but nevertheless, we Palestinians must understand something. We have to continue resisting. We have to keep in touch, and this is also important. Being Palestinian, of course, it is important, but being Palestinian is not only maintaining the culture of the stuffed pumpkin or others, so to speak. Being Palestinian also requires getting involved in the cause, be informed, read, debate, and never ever surrender, because the law and history will always be with us, so we should never sit back in ignorance. We should be ready and informed in the sense that we always have to present in arguments.
Do you talk to your relatives in Palestine regularly?
Yes, every day generally, by video call. We talk with our relatives, and the news we get is always painful. News about people getting killed, the murder of relatives, people we know, an acquaintance in Bethlehem, for example, and others by the Zionists. They only allow them to cross by a relative through the checkpoints. It's just painful. So that relationship, which is obviously rooted in love, but at the same time very painful because of the news, which is never good. We maintain it constantly.
La mantenemos constantemente.
When was the last time you traveled to Palestine?
2022,
when the pandemic was ending. And how many times have you traveled to Palestine?
I have had the opportunity to go there 5 times, but 3 times constantly. The first time I was baptized in Palestine, it was the Church of St. Nicholas. There I was baptized. During all the 5 times that I had the chance to travel to Palestine, there have been humiliations, because here we must understand something. Apartheid is not only in the occupied Palestinian territory and also within Israel, but it also affects Chileans of Palestinian origin when they travel to Palestine. They humiliate us in the airports and they humiliate us at the borders, because Palestine does not have control of its own borders, and when one tries to enter Palestine, they strip us naked, they interrogate us, they ask us if we have bombs. I mean, what is this? And it's just for having a different last name. And that apartheid has reached Chileans of Palestinian origin, and that is why the Chilean state must also protect its citizens like any other country.
Well, it hasn't, has it? Of all the times that Chilean citizens have been deported, the state of Chile has never said anything, despite the fact that Israel and Chile maintain, to this day, a free migration agreement that should give freedom of movement to Chilean citizens traveling to Palestine. For the closing section, because time is always short in this type of programs, what message would you send today, both to young Chileans of Palestinian descent and to young Chileans who have no blood relationship with the territory? Because the Chilean government, in general, analyzes the history of the resistance and the Chilean people, and one remembers, for example, how they mobilized for the war in Vietnam. There were demonstrations here every day to stop the war in Vietnam. In the Palestinian case, one remembers already in 1947, when the partition of Palestine was being discussed in the United Nations, there was a mobilization of the Palestinian community that forced the Chilean government to abstain. When all those who were subordinate to North American foreign policy voted in favor of a partition, the only ones who did not contemplate were the Palestinians. What message would you give today when this genocide is ongoing, happening in Palestine, some call it the Holy Land, to all the young people who are watching us?
To all the young Palestinians who are listening to the program, first of all, tell them that whenever they are in the university, in educational centers, in political organizations, always, always keep the Palestinian cause present and alive. And the main message in particular is that never get intimidated, because lately I've seen that certain youth become a little afraid of the stigma of anti-Semitic. I would like to emphasize something here. We're condemning and criticizing a political, nationalist, ideological movement such as Zionism, because Zionism, on the other hand, is one that has co-opted a religion and has nationalized and politicized a religion. But we're not criticizing co-opted religion or instrumentalized religion. And that is a message that I want to leave to young people, that they do not let themselves be intimidated, that they continue their activism for Palestinians. It is not enough just to listen to Arabic music, which is, of course, important for culture, or, I don't know, smoke a hookah or eat Arabic food on Sundays. These things are culturally important, but they are never enough. For this, we have to study, we have to read, we have to participate in student and political movements and carry the Palestinian cause whenever we are, at any place. They say that Israel has bought the values of the West and is avant-garde in terms of values in the West Asia. And the truth is that we do not have to admit it, because Israel is the only regime that has issued death certificates rather than birth certificates to hundreds and thousands of babies in Palestine, and that it is avant-garde in terms of selective murders, demolition of houses, construction of colonies, and not respecting the international law, which has justified their own origin.
¿Qué justificó también su propio origen?
Te doy las gracias nuevamente por haber aceptado esta invitación.
I thank you again for accepting this invitation. I believe that at this point, no one in the world dares to even refer to supposed Western values, because the ongoing genocide is being carried out with the full support, with the shipment of weapons from all the Western powers, from the European Axis, from the United States and Canada to Israel. There is no shame, though, and this is all happening with the inaction of the Arab governments that, while the Palestinians are being exterminated, are advancing in the normalization of relations with the Zionist regime. I thank you for your presence again and invite you to a short break. We'll be back soon. The resistance of the Palestinian people in the last 100, 120 years has gone through various stages and has crossed all forms of struggle. And each form of struggle, in one way or another, has been conditioned by the actions first of the Zionist movement, which was the one that imported the most brutal terrorism to the West Asian region, and then by the actions of the Zionist regime, which from the beginning always had in their perspective the goal of appropriating all of the Palestinians' land, but without the Palestinians. Already at the end of the 19th century, when the first migratory flows promoted by the Zionist Congress, held in 1897, began to materialize, the Palestinians first opened their arms to contain the Jews who had been fleeing from the programs of Tsarist Russia. However, when they began to perceive that these migratory currents were not only coming to seek refuge, but were coming to expel their inhabitants and appropriate the land, they began a form of resistance that at first was absolutely peaceful and non-violent. There was no practice of armed resistance because during the Ottoman Turkish Empire, protests and peaceful non-violent resistance had always been a way of showing discontent. However, after the end of the First World War, when the Sykes-Picot Agreement was announced, in which the Western powers divided the entire Arab world that remained after the destruction of the Ottoman Turkish Empire into areas of influence, and they began to perceive with the Balfour Declaration that Great Britain was committed to giving the land of the Palestinians to the World Zionist Organization, the Palestinians began to radicalize their positions and began to first resist the supposed British mandate that should lead them towards independence. Then later, in 1936, in the Great Arab Revolution, they began to not only resist immigration, but also the sale of land by Palestinians to the Zionist organization. And of course, after the beginning of the terrorist operations of the Irgun or Etzel, which are Zionist paramilitary organizations that brought the fighting methods of the First World War and the Second World War to Palestine, the first glimpses of armed struggle and more violent resistance emerged. This is no coincidence. As the Zionist regime began to show its true colors and began to usurp more Palestinian lands and violate their rights, Palestinians began to organize. After the 1948 war, when the Zionists seized 80% of the Palestinian territory and expelled more than 800,000 people from their cities and demolished more than 500 Palestinian villages, the armed struggle of the Palestinian nation began and resistance organizations emerged. Among them, the General Union of Palestinian Students, the first organization of a fundamentally political nature of the Palestinian people. The resistance began to be organized mainly from the borders of the territories occupied at the same time from Jordan and Egypt by the Zionist regime. This triggered an increase in violence. The Suez Canal War came and then the Six-Day War. These events caused the emergence of a much more concrete political military formations of the Palestinian nation. A little before the War of Suez, Fatah, a little after the 1967 war, the emergence of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine at the hands of Dr. George Habash al-Hakim, better known as Hakim or the Wise. And from then on, the Organization for the Liberation of Palestine was first appeared. Over 30 Palestinian political organizations were formed, within which a group of them ended up merging and culminating in the emergence of this Popular Front. The Popular Front later had numerous small branches, but the point is that they would complete a scenario in which the Palestine resistance encompassed all forms of struggle and committed all Palestinians inside and outside Palestine in the objective of liberating their land and achieving for themselves the right to self-determination. Shortly after, we witnessed the total occupation not only of Palestine, but also of the Golan Heights, the Negev Desert, and a large part of the southern border of Lebanon by the Israelis. The conflict extended and turned into a severe regional dispute. After several failures of the resistance that came from the outside of the borders of occupied Palestine, an initiative began to develop and to change the axis of the resistance from outside Palestine to inside. And following the defeat of 1982 and the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Lebanon, the departure of some populations and the internal confrontation in the Bekaa Valley, the first intifada began to take shape that would forever change the history of the resistance, locating its central axis in the occupied territories. First Intifada, Second Intifada, and after that, the Gulf and the International Peace Conference in Oslo. Palestinians have always sought peace and their rights for having a democratic, independent, and sovereign Palestinian state in Palestine and with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. This is what the international law recognizes for the people of Palestine.
Al pueblo palestino.
Before finishing, I want to offer you the floor in case any of you have any questions to ask.
Hello, Daniel. I'm Constanza Inestrosa, a journalism student. And I wanted to know, based on what we see today and the fact that peaceful coexistence is not possible between these two, I would like to know if you can suggest any alternative that can solve this problem.
Okay, Constanza. Thank you very much.
Hello, Daniel. My name is Elizabeth. We have seen the brutality of the occupiers' plan, and we have seen the resistance that has occurred within this framework. Do you think that this resistance can set foot in these areas, other areas such as Lebanon and Yemen?
I want to thank you for both questions, but I will start with Elizabeth's, and I will end with Constanza's questions. First, because we must understand that the territory that we know today as Palestine plays a fundamental role in the history of the region. Palestine, since the beginning of history, is the place where the first religions arose. It is the place where the first cities arose, Ariha. It is the place where agriculture was discovered and where the first storage silos in the history of humanity are located. Of course, they were not in vain, as along with the surplus is born the division of the world into social classes and the separation between the countryside and the city. With the emergence of monotheistic religions, Palestine becomes the ideological center, ideology understood as this set of ideas that characterizes a certain group of people, billions of people throughout the world. And therefore, what happens in Palestine directly impacts Muslims, Jews, Christians, and supporters of some religions that are already extinct. Therefore, if one thinks about what Yemen has done today, what Hezbollah is doing today in Lebanon, what some actors of the Iraqi resistance are doing in Iraq against the North American military occupation in Iraq, this is not very different to the sentiments of all Arab peoples who are fundamentally part of the great Arab nation. One cannot forget that nation states in the Arab world are less than 100 years old. In the past, they belonged to an area that was concentrated and politically unified around what was first the Ottoman Empire, And it was long before the different city nations and the different Persian, Babylonian, and Assyrian empires. Therefore, one cannot keep silent and be indifferent towards the impact that each event that occurs in Palestine has on all the peoples of the region. In this aspect, or in this context, it is also important to highlight that the Zionist project speaks of the formation of Eretz Israel, or the same land of Israel. But this land does not even exist and has never existed. In that case, how do they speak of a land that spans from the Nile to the Euphrates? This is the meaning of the flag of Israel, which is the Star of David between the two rivers, and therefore, if we want to have a realistic look at this situation, it would seem that the Israelis want to occupy much more than Palestine, because I am sorry, but it has nothing to do with religion. I mean, in no case is it a religious problem. This is a problem that has to do with the struggle for power and for world hegemony. And today, Zionism and Israelis are the main instruments of transnational capital to take over all the markets and all the natural resources that still exist. It is not under its control. And regarding the question raised by our guest Constanza, I have to say that the two-state solution is not viable. Thinking about dividing a historically consolidated territory with a single identity into two has no precedent, so there is nothing that can allow it to appear viable. It is as if in South African apartheid, instead of dismantling apartheid, the solution would have been to split South Africa in two, into a black state and a white state. It would never have worked because there is no possibility of peaceful coexistence when what you create are confessional states. States that do not understand the delivery and unity of the entire human race and of all matter at the world level. Since its birth, the PLO has always proposed that the only solution was the construction of a secular, democratic Palestinian state that had religious freedom and that would be the home of every Jew, Christian, Muslim, or atheist who wanted to live in and fight for a Palestine that contains all of those characteristics. This idea, which had been discarded after Oslo, gained strength again through the joint work of Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim, a Palestinian citizen and an Israeli citizen. They have declared that the only possibility today is a plurinational state where all its citizens have the same duties and rights, where total religious freedom exists and which is part of all religious fundamentalism, be it Christian, Muslim, or Zionist.
Musulman o sionista.
In the Palestine of the last century, to live is to resist, and the Palestinians are convinced to remain in the land of their birth at any cost. They know that they were there before the first invader arrived, and that they will continue to be in that land after the last one leaves.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is
Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the Master of the Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned.
کاشان شاید یه چیزی حدود 70 سال پیش یه میرزا حبیب الله کاشانی بود که کتاباش
Around 70 years ago in the city of Kashan in Iran there was a man by the name of Mirza Habibullah Kashani whose profession was recalling the tragedies of Karbala and reciting lamentations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Since he was great in this profession, his time was full during the month of Muharram and he was present at different majalis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Once, an old lady stopped him on the street and asked him to come and host the majlis of Imam al-Hussein for 10 days in her house. Mirza Habibullah was very much busy and gave a time to the lady which he thought she would not accept. That was 2 p.m., which is not considered a good time to hold the majlis for the guests and the neighbors. Finally, he accepted going to the old lady's majlis and recited a few words of lamentations and left the majlis soon. Karbala,
as I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your skies.
Toshod Ruza Ashura.
The day of Ashura came and Mirza Habibullah was busy, so he forgot to tell the old lady that he cannot attend her session on that day. It was near the noon that he became tired and took a nap. In his dreams, he saw a lady who introduced herself as Fatima, the mother of Hussein. In his dream, Hazrat Fatima asked the man not to forget the majlis of the old lady for Imam al-Hussein. Upon seeing this, he woke up and ran to the house of the old lady, where he found the old lady anxious about Mirza being late. Upon reaching her, Mirza was told by the old lady, "Where are you, Mirza? Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra is waiting for the majlis for her son, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein." The main lesson that we take from this event is that the main hosts for the majalis of Imam al-Hussein are the members of the Ahl al-Bayt themselves. Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hazrat Fatima, Zahra, and other respected members of the Ahl al-Bayt. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist lobby plays down the amount it spends on influencing policy in the United States. So in today's show, we'll be laying bare the reality. To set the scene, Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about the way in which the Zionist lobby's expenditure is reported.
AIPAC, or to give it its full name, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is perhaps the best known Israel lobby group in the world. But how important is it really? Some say that its influence has been exaggerated and that, in the end, the most it can do is influence policies at the margins. Certainly, the Zionist movement is keen to downplay its influence. Here is a report in the tablet. How influential is AIPAC? Less than beer sellers, public accountants, and Toyota. Among the points made are that the way AIPAC is talked about, you'd think they'd be a lobbying juggernaut, surely one of the largest in the nation's capital. Wrong. Between 1998 and 2018, AIPAC didn't make a dent in the Center for Responsive Politics' list of the top spending lobbying groups. In 2018, total pro-Israel lobbying spending was around $5 million, of which AIPAC accounted for $3.5 million. In contrast, Native American casinos spent around $22 million that year. By tablet's count, AIPAC was the 147th highest ranked entity in terms of lobbying spending in 2018. This is an attempt to pretend that the influence of the Zionist movement is much less than suggested by critics. Against that, we can set the following. Taking the figure disclosed to the lobbying regulator as if that was all AIPAC spends on lobbying is profoundly mistaken. Though it disclosed only $2.7 million lobby expenditure in 2022, its actual expenditure was $79.1 million. In addition, AIPAC controls another nonprofit, which it uses to pursue Zionist interests, which discloses nothing to the regulator, yet had a 2022 expenditure of a further $44.6 million. Looking more widely at the Israel lobby in general, in fact, declared lobbying expenditure by the lobby in 2018 was $7 million, not around $5 million, as stated by the tablet. The figure for 2022 was $5.4 million. But even that is woefully inadequate, as it does not include, for example, the $6.3 million spent in 2022 by Israeli firms, including arms firms, Elbit, Rafael, Israel Aerospace Industries, and phone hacking firm, Celebrite. $16 million in the same year spent by registered foreign agents of Israel, including the government, the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, and the phone hacking firm, NSO Group. But even that pales into insignificance when compared with the data compiled by the IsraelLobby.org website. Data compiled there on Zionist groups providing subsidy to the Zionist entity, including to illegal settlements and the occupation forces, and lobbying and education, shows a total budget of $3.6 billion as long ago as 2012, rising to an estimate $6.3 billion in 2020. It's time to get real about the spending power of the lobby.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert and eminent scholarly critic of Israel, David Miller. David's a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University, and he's a co-director of a lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Today's guest contributor is an American human rights lawyer, Dan Kovalik. Dan taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh until last year, and he's written extensively too. His books have focused on human rights and US foreign policy, and his latest book, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, was published in May this year and includes a foreword by George Galloway. Welcome to the show. David, what's behind the rationale then, do you think, with the Zionists trying to minimise the influence of AIPAC?
Well, the Zionists try and pretend that they don't really exist. I mean, when you say that an organisation is a Zionist organisation, they quite often say, oh, no, it's just an ordinary Jewish communal organisation. And you point out that in their constitution they say they support Israel or that they're affiliated to the World Zionist Organization. They don't want to have any open conversation about what the Zionist movement